do Jacksonville's roads need to go on a diet to better protect pedestrians? We'll take a closer look just ahead. Good Tuesday morning and happy August. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download our WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime or on iTunes. You can stream us live right now, too, on our Facebook page. Just ahead, it's the new transportation trend, road diets. What that means for our First Coast road plan. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's today's movable feast as Lee Court takes a little sample of some delicious Claude's chocolate. Plus, is the country doing the right things to prepare for the workforce of the future? How to survive automation on your job? That's in the book, Humility is the New Smart. We'll tell you about it, all of that ahead. But first this hour, road diets. Now, before we explain what that means, a little background. New development over the past few years in Jacksonville's Brooklyn neighborhood has been a welcome addition to the area. The shopping, restaurants, and apartments have really revolutionized that whole corridor. But it has also increased foot traffic. And with Riverside Avenue, a six-lane road, it can be difficult, maybe even near impossible sometimes, for pedestrians to get across the street. That's a problem in many areas around town. In fact, according to the most recent Pedestrian Danger Index out by the National Complete Streets Coalition recently, Jacksonville ranks as the fourth most dangerous city for pedestrians in the country. So that's where this concept of road diets comes in. What does it mean exactly? Right now, we've got a closer look as we welcome Alan Iosu. He's director of development for Pond. That's the Georgia firm hired by Jacksonville's Downtown Investment Authority to study Riverside Avenue. And he joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Melissa.
Here's our question to callers. How concerned are you about congestion around town, dangers for pedestrians and cyclists? What do you think about the concept of road diets? What are your questions? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or you can weigh in on Facebook where we are streaming this show live right now. Okay, let me begin first off by asking you. I'd never heard of this term before. What's a road diet?
So a road diet is a term that some transportation planners have used to describe taking an existing right-of-way with a road and repurposing the lanes. A lot of times they'll say lane elimination too, which is not always the right fix. But really, what we're looking at is adding multimodal ability. So bicycles, pedestrians, transit, and the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. And adding multimodal ability, more complete streets. You're accommodating more types of transportation on the street other than
correct.
Cars and trucks.
Correct. And a complete street can be different in each context. You could have a Riverside, which is a larger thoroughfare, or you could have a local street that can still be complete by just having those modes taken care of and being able to use the road.
Now, traditionally in America, we always think bigger is better. We just keep widening streets when they get congested. The new thinking is not necessarily do that. Put the road on a diet. Actually make it narrower, right?
Right. And not every road is the right situation to do that. But what you're seeing is you're seeing a transformation in how people want to live. And they want to be able to walk. They want to be able to take their bikes. They don't always want to have to rely on the automobile. Which Florida, as you saw by that report, 8 of the top 10 worst pedestrian death index cities were in Florida. Mm-hmm. And so Florida was built around the vehicle. And now we're going through this transformation of looking at other modes, and transit's a big one. The generations that are coming up, they don't want to have a car. You've heard the millennials, they don't really want to drive as early as everybody else used to. So they want walkability, and they want to be able to get from point A to point B without having to rely on the vehicle.
And if you're just tuning in, do Jacksonville's roads need to be put on a diet? Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. So Jacksonville, the fourth most dangerous city in America for walking. People are getting killed out there. Tell us about Riverside Avenue and what your study of that whole corridor has found, because in recent years, as we said, it's exploded with development.
Right. So really our concept there and our goal with the city was to look at Brooklyn, the whole neighborhood. So we're actually looking at three corridors, Riverside, Park Street, which runs parallel, and then Forest Street, which intersects and leads off of I-95. So those three corridors all have to do with that neighborhood. We couldn't just look at Riverside because it's really the neighborhood context and the future development that could occur there. So, you know, the whole neighborhood is growing and changing, and currently it's being used somewhat as a throughput for vehicles. So The goal is to find a way to have all those uses in a safe manner.
How has this concept worked in other cities, Alan?
So you'll see lots of cities that are really ahead of where we are right now. And what they're doing is really repurposing the road. And it works really well. You'll see it in urban situations first because it's easier to bring in the transit, bring in buses, and have more walkability. Mm-hmm. So there's successful cities that are doing this right now. And we're soon to be one of those successful cities. I see it coming here.
You think it'll make its way to Jacksonville?
I do. Right now you have River Place Boulevard has a project going on. That'll be one. JTA's got a whole program of complete streets that we're working on as well. The change is coming, and hopefully we can all adopt it and have a safer place for our kids.
And going beyond Jacksonville, just this morning, the Florida Department of Transportation reports it's considering some different measures that could make cities safer for pedestrians and cyclists, like reducing speed limits in different cities from 45 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour, narrowing streets, adding bicycle lanes, adding traffic circles, widening sidewalks, putting in little obstacles to deter jaywalking. This is something that's happening across Florida.
Right. The DOT has a new policy coming out, the Complete Streets policy, and they're looking at how to adopt this and really help this movement across the state. And speed's the number one thing. Speed kills. Your reaction time is much lower the faster you're going. So our whole goal through all of this is to reduce those speeds so you can react quickly when you see a pedestrian or a bicyclist.
What's the timetable for the road diet in Brooklyn?
So
how much weight is that road going to lose?
Well, so the corridors that we're looking at right now, we're going through a process. We just had a public meeting last week on Thursday where we got public input. That was a DDRB meeting. We'll have another one we're looking at September, which will have the final concept. We basically put together three alternatives for each corridor. And then we'll wrap up in late September by putting together a package for the DIA that will give you short-term and long-term recommendations with some cost options. So then they'll have to go forward and try and find some funding. Funding's always an issue.
What would be a ballpark figure for this?
Oh, I can't give you that right now. I mean, each one's a little different. We have some short terms that could be, you know, a few thousand dollars, and then we have some long term that could be, you know, a couple hundred thousand to make some changes.
If the city goes ahead with all of your recommendations, what will that corridor look like after the project's completed?
Well, I think you'll see eventually in years if they do the right choices there, and we'll be able to make the changes we want to make. You'll see a lot of more economic development. You'll see those corridors actually build up more because the parking will be there, the walkability will be there. So you could see Brooklyn, you know, be a nice urban core down there and really mm-hmm. have a good mix of residential and commercial. You already have a lot of offices, so you just want that full work-live-play atmosphere.
Okay, let's go to your calls now. What do you think about this? Does the street in your neighborhood need a road diet? What are your concerns about Jacksonville's well-known dangers for pedestrians and cyclists? How do you think we need to improve this? It's 549-2937. Give us a call with your transportation thoughts. Jimmy in Riverside. Hey, Jimmy, good morning.
How you doing, Melissa? Thanks so much for talking about this, guys. I love this topic.
Sure.
I've heard about the Vision Zero concept, and what I understand it's being used a lot in northeastern cities. Is that something that can happen in some of the newer cities like Jacksonville with sort of this suburban sprawl? If so, where do you think it can be used? And, I mean, you know, thanks for doing this stuff. I appreciate it, guys.
Oh, yeah, sure. And the Vision Zero plan he mentioned, that's being implemented in Fort Lauderdale, the first Florida city to join this national movement. More bike lanes, wider sidewalks, slower speeds. Tell me a little bit about Vision Zero, Alan.
Right. I believe Hillsborough County has a Vision Zero plan as well. And basically, that's your goal. You want zero pedestrian deaths. And so it's basically, I believe the way it works, I'm not an expert in the background of that, but I believe there's special funding you can get if you have a Vision Zero plan in place. And I think that is something that we could look at as a city. And there's some good, obviously some good examples around the country that are using that. I know we've talked about it a little bit with some other leaders within in the city. I just don't think we've come up with that plan yet, but I do think it's a good plan to try and initiate.
549-2937, Nan. Hi, Nan in San Marco. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I was wondering if there's any plans to help out the Mandarin community. My daughter's preschool teacher was actually struck by a driver and killed a few years ago. And there's hundreds of members of the Jewish community that walk every Friday night and Saturday morning. Traffic's horrific 24/7 out there. And I was wondering if there's any plans to help that community moderate the traffic situation and help the pedestrians there.
Yeah, thank you for that. And she's right. And there have been some tragic deaths in Mandarin of folks walking to their local synagogue and trying to cross when the light is only green for what seems like about 30 seconds and they can't get across in time and they've been run over. It's been a nightmare.
Yeah, and those stories give me chills because there's too much of that happening, especially when you hear about children and teachers and any life like that. So, you know, what I recommend is your community gets together, get with your council folks. Really, a lot of those initiatives that have happened across the country start ground roots to push that. And you have to be a voice for your community and use your council people to get out there and help you, because that's the number one way to do it is you have to have a voice.
You know, I used to live along another road in this area, Kernan Boulevard. It was for many years a two-lane road, and it was a deadly road. In fact, one night I'll never forget, I remember driving home from work with my daughter in the back seat. She was only 3 or 4 years old, and there was a dead body lying in the street that had just been covered with a sheet. A young girl was going out jogging, a Fletcher High School student, and she tried to cross this two-lane road in heavy rush hour traffic and got killed. A local activist for that corridor, he was the head of my homeowners association, this guy named Bill Kintz. He just did exactly what you said. He became the squeaky wheel, and he forced the city council to widen that road, and right. It's now a six-lane road. It has bike lanes. It has sidewalks, but it didn't go on a diet. It got bigger.
Right.
What's interesting about what you're saying is that now the trend is coming back around to where we're saying, hey, before we think about going crazy widening roads, let's look at the bigger picture.
Right. And I drive Kernan quite a bit. I live over in that area and used to live off of Kernan when it was the two-lane, and I remember that situation. You know, driving Kernan right now, the speeds are much more than the posted speed limit. I would not say that it's any safer besides for the fact that you have a multi-use trail that people can obviously jog on. The bike lanes are okay. They're not really protected bike lanes. So there's still things.
By the way, how do you protect a bike lane? Because I see people out on the bike lanes and I think, yeah, there's nothing stopping a car from killing them but a little white line.
Right.
So, I mean, how do you protect it?
The new protected bike lane is actually multiple different ways. You can do striping, so just an additional 3 feet of striping to give that buffer.
Okay.
So that the car has a little more time to adjust if it does veer off. Or you can actually build a median or some sort of other, separator that's a hardened surface. Also, you could do landscaping. You could have a little landscape strip. So there's different ways to do it, and you'll see in our concepts we have some alternatives as well on how to do that. But it's just giving a little more room, basically.
So as we look at this going forward, are we going to see more and more widening along with the complete streets, or are we going to see more of this push toward perhaps even narrowing roads to discourage more traffic and encourage more pedestrian and bicycle traffic?
I think you'll see more of the highway connectivity will continue to build on capacity, but your local roads that are going through communities, they have to go through this process. And one of the things, too, is our standard lane width is like 12 feet right now. A road diet is also narrowing those lanes. And when you narrow lanes, then you also slow traffic because you hit that feel of, well, that car is really close to me. Maybe I should drive a little slower. So that's also one thing we're looking at Riverside is in that area is narrowing the lanes themselves.
Let's go to Rob in Avondale now. Hi, Rob. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say I think this is a great idea. If you look at South Florida and kind of what their traffic situation is down there, if widening was a good idea, they would be in great shape. But no, they've actually got 8 and 10 lanes in certain places, full traffic, and it's a horrible commute. It's a horrible situation. The other thing I would say is that there needs to be a change in directives at the state level with the DOT, because there are tons of funds pouring out of the state into bigger, wider, faster roads that are completely against kind of these objectives of putting people a little bit more towards the front. So how are we going to change that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. What about his point?
Well, it's true. I mean, again, we are at a shift in our culture, a shift in how roads are being designed. It takes time. It takes time to get everybody on board with the notion. They are making steps. You know, like I mentioned earlier, they're coming out with a complete streets manual for the DOT. So they are going in that direction. But like any change, it takes time. And you really need those advocates to continue to push.
Lots of calls as we talk about this idea of road diets. Tom on the west side. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Yes. Good morning. I was just going to question whether all these benefits can be achieved by passive means when the typical driving mode in Jacksonville is road rage, aggression, and impatience.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be a component of JSO doing more to police the roads and keep us safe. And that's what I think it's going to take to reduce the fatality rate in the city.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. You know, one thing that the JSO did, it was controversial, but it was an attempt to get at what Tom's saying is they put in intersection red light cameras. That's one example of the way they've tried to police this issue.
Right. And that has worked in some situations. I do agree. I think, you know, again, going back to speed, you know, when you have a 45 mile an hour posted speed limit, but people are driving 60, you know, who's regulating that, and how do we get a better handle on that? Because that's typically what happens. You have distracted drivers that are going faster than they should be, and you have pedestrians that are trying to cross safely. So
if FDOT is recommending lowering speeds in cities around the state, are we looking at, like, I'll give an example, a street I drive all the time, Beach Boulevard.
Right.
And I forget what the speed limit is. I think it's 45.
Probably 45.
Is FDOT going to say, no, you know, from now on, you're going to go 35 on a road like that?
I think they'll probably have to go through each context of where the street is and how it functions. I'm not sure. I mean, yeah. It's interesting to see if they could do that.
Because, as you said, if it's a 45-mile-an-hour thoroughfare, nobody's going 45 miles an hour down that
right.
road.
Right.
They're going 55, sometimes 60.
Right.
They're treating it like a highway.
And part of that is there's too many lanes. It's too easy to do that. So, and you know, then you got to look at what is the real delay? What is your real delay if you're going 45 versus 60? Probably not that much, because you'll get caught at light. You see it all the time. People try and jump ahead, and they get caught at light, and they're in the exact same spot they would have been if they were going 45.
It's always one of the hottest topics on the show. Transportation. Yes. What do you think about this concept of road diets as we talk about it this morning? Patrick is in Avondale. Hey, Patrick. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I just had a quick comment. I live in Avondale, and I ride around quite a bit. I'd love to see a corridor connecting the Riverwalk up by Ram all the way down to Avondale. And there's a street where it'd be great, Herschel, but instead of bike lanes or some kind of bike route, they have street parking. And it makes for a troublesome ride to the neighborhood.
I'm sure it does.
We actually, no, it's a good point. The Riverwalk's a great asset of the city. And one of the things we heard when we were doing our public outreach was the lack of connectivity from Riverside over to the Riverwalk. It was not really obvious to some people that you could get over there. So we are looking at some options to how to connect the bicycle and peds a little bit clearer, maybe even doing some wayfinding signage throughout the Brooklyn neighborhood to be able to let people know it's there. So.
Is there anything people can look at online while you work on this?
Well, everything that we just presented, I believe, is public record through the DIA and the Downtown Development Review Board. And then we'll have it, like I said, we'll have another public meeting coming out in September. So we'd, you know, love people to come out and support it or voice their concerns.
We'll go back to some more of your calls in a moment, but lots of comments about this idea of road diets on social media from our Facebook page. Donald writes, making streets more pedestrian friendly is long overdue. Street planning needs to involve more than just motor vehicles. Pedestrians, public transport need to be included. When I visited England, all the streets felt much more pedestrian friendly than any I've walked along in this country. City planners could learn a lot from the English. Laura writes, the speed limit on Bay Meadows needs to be reduced. Traffic has increased tremendously there. It should be no more than 35 miles an hour. I know Bay Meadows had been declared a failing road. Mm. I think it still is, as a matter of fact. That's
it depends on what portion of Bay Meadows.
Depends on what part. Here's a tweet from Rob. The word diet is out in today's lingo. We want sugar-free, less driving to get places and more local options to walk to. Here's an email for you. Jacksonville has a problem with taking crosswalks seriously. Add more crosswalks. Is that part of the plan?
That is. And one thing we also, the term mid-block crossing happens a lot in this concept of road diets and complete streets, is you have large block sections where people won't cross. They won't go down to the light and cross. They'll actually try and cut across in a mid-block situation. So we do look at mid-block crossings and trying to do some flashing beacons or something to alert the driver that those are there. But yeah, I agree. Crosswalks and just the mentality of the pedestrian has the right of way. In Florida, you don't see that.
So. Absolutely not. In fact, it almost seems sometimes as though people look at pedestrians like they're target practice. I mean, you really do almost take your life in your hands. How do you change? I mean, you can change the infrastructure on the ground, Alan, but how do you change the culture?
You know, it's a tough one. I mean, until you hear a story of, someone actually being affected by something like this, a lot of times people just don't think about it. It's great to have all these callers and all these comments coming in because obviously we're not alone in the thought process here. But, it takes time. It takes voices. It takes mm-hmm. people just trying to spread the word and having a different attitude about things. Slow down a little bit.
Yeah. Good advice. Lots of calls. Let's get to a few more. Jason in St. John's County. Jason, I know we're talking about Duval County, but St. John's County has its own issues on this as well, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Hi, Melissa. This is Jay, and thanks for taking my call. I do believe, two things stand out for me in St. John's County. When I look at... I think there's kudos that need to be granted to the FDOT. I think the expansion of Jacksonville, the wider Jacksonville area, I think one needs to recognize that the FDOT is doing as much as they can, expansion, road expansions, bike lanes, rumble stripe removal, trying to make safer roads. But I think what's also needed is a study of the roads. Those areas in Jacksonville where you do have crashes and accidents, that those need to be studied and those need to be solved. So almost like a map needs to be devised where the problems are occurring, and I think some study needs to be put behind it, some resources around how do we solve those problem areas throughout Jacksonville. You mentioned Mandarin, Bay Meadows, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jay.
No, great point, and I think that is what you're seeing. You may not be seeing it on the front lines, but there are folks that are studying those high incident areas.
There's a couple of, let me just point out, North Florida Transportation Planning mm-hmm. Organization, they're actually an underwriter here, and the local regional planning council, they have office space here in our building. I know they look at those big picture issues.
They do, and we have a bike ped coordinator that's going through that. They have a master plan going on. So a lot of that goes into those other reports. It may just not be out there in the public realm, but no, good point.
William in Riverside. Hey, William, how are things your way?
They're good, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. One thing I wanted to push on here is, I mean, first of all, it's hard to solve these problems here because if you Google urban sprawl, you might as well get a picture of Jacksonville. We are like the textbook definition of it. So that's an incredibly difficult problem on its own to deal with as far as like road infrastructure. But like one of the biggest problems I see like driving here and then driving, well, pretty much anywhere in the region is that we just don't teach people how traffic works when we are educating them and they're getting their driver's license. You figure out how some signs work, you do a test, you do a three-point turn, and we let you drive. We don't teach you that traffic works as a fluid, that traffic jams are compression waves, and that if you enforce space between you and every other car, you reduce the pressure in the system and the traffic jam will dissolve. And then we don't teach people that, like, you don't travel in the left-hand lane. That's a passing lane. Everybody needs to default to the right-hand side of the road unless you're trying to get around someone. We don't teach people how to drive, so nobody drives correctly.
Uh-oh. I hope he didn't just get hit. Oh, there you are. Hey, William.
Okay. Did I cut out?
Hey, yeah, you cut out for just a second. I was concerned that maybe you were in an accident.
We're distracted.
We're driving safe. We got room.
Okay, thanks for the... Thank you, William. What about his point?
No, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, it goes back to that enforcement comment earlier. Traveling in the left lane, that's an enforcement thing. It's not being enforced. And there is an education. You know, again, I look at what's coming, the wave of new drivers, the autonomous vehicles. I mean, we're about to come
Absolutely.
Into a whole new world.
That's going to radically reshape the
right.
way our roads look.
Right. And so what he's talking about and some of those abilities of these vehicles to start taking over the driver's choices is going to change how the roads look, too. So.
If you're just tuning in, as we speak with Alan Iosu of Pond, that's the firm advising Jacksonville's Downtown Investment Authority on this concept. What are your thoughts about road diets, putting our bloated, crammed roads on a diet, so to speak, so that fewer people on foot and on bicycles die? Kathy emails the show, in Ponte Vedra, we have an issue with A1A and County Road 210 going into Nocatee. We need more access points. This idea of road diets might encourage more alternative vehicle use, making all of the traffic jams obsolete. Demetrius emails the show, when I was in Spain, crosswalks were not in the intersection, but 10 to 15 feet before the intersection, making it easier to negotiate for cars and pedestrians alike. That is a good idea. Here's an email from Barbara. Have city planners looked at the European transportation model, where cities are bike-friendly and have more public transit options?
Yes, we do. And we have one of our team members has written books and toured Europe. And so there's a lot of insight that you can gather from the European model and what's happening over there. Their streets are much different. They were always built a little bit smaller. So they've had a lot of opportunity to repurpose and add more pedestrian and bicycle facilities.
And we're also getting emails pointing out that we're one of the fattest cities in America, along with one of the least walkable. And those two things are not unrelated.
Right. You never want to wake up and hear that. But
Okay. Let's take just a few more calls. Dick is on the north side. Hi, Dick.
Hello. How are you doing today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two things. I was wondering if is there a way to get the crosswalk actual signal to tell the light to last a little longer when a pedestrian is there wanting to cross? And is there a program to actually teach pedestrians not to walk out into traffic so that people don't get hit, as in Alan said earlier, in the half block before they actually cross that intersection?
Well, that part's a tough education because people make their own choices, and it is a it is a tough thing to change because you can't address every single individual. As far as the signals, there are ways to interconnect the signal and have basically identification that there is a pedestrian in there. That technology obviously is out there. It just costs infrastructure money to adapt.
Cheryl is in Murray Hill. Hey, Cheryl. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Yes, I'm calling kind of about the same thing. There's a major intersection here, Roosevelt and St. John's Avenue.
Sure.
And I believe it's six lanes on Roosevelt Crossing. And if you're there at the proper crosswalk, you push the button, you're on a bike. If you're running, if you're walking, it'll say walk. You can get about a third of the way across, and that light has changed, and traffic is on, and you're, like, scampering to get to the middle, and it's ridiculous. And I would like to know, who can I talk to get that address, because it's been like that for years.
Yeah, and that's such a common complaint. And it, as we were pointing out, thank you, Cheryl, for that. As we were pointing out a minute ago, Alan, that's led to some deaths. That seems like it would not be that difficult to fix.
It should not be. Again, it goes back to my point. Be a voice. Get with your city council member. Let them know what's happening there. The city traffic engineer should be able to look at that and do a study to see if they can adjust the timing. Or if it's DOT right of way, you could reach out to them as well.
And as we mentioned, too, each neighborhood sort of needs a loud voice who has a talent for being extremely persistent over a long period of time.
Correct.
That's really what makes the change, isn't it?
Right.
Okay. Martin at the beaches. Hello, Martin.
Good morning. This is a great show. I just wanted to make a couple comments. I'm glad that we're talking about this. One of the major issues I find, I'm traveling actually right behind a trailer that's wider than the truck, and it's almost touching both white lines. I think before you start talking about narrowing anything, you need to start talking about enforcement and citation opportunities for reducing accidents. Trailer sizes are just way too wide, the vehicles that pull them are too narrow. And I think that that causes opportunities for blind spots as well as accidents and just not being able to manage what they have on the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. Thanks for that observation. Yeah, and he's describing what he's seeing out there right now.
Right.
Thanks for that, Martin. One more call. Steve in Springfield. Hey, Steve. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Alan. How you doing? This is Steve.
Good morning, Steve.
Hey, Alan, we know each other. But anyway, I want, you know, a great show there, but wanted to just mention, ask a question if this Riverside study is going to do any connectivity to Springfield. You know, we've got what we call the S-Line, which is a urban trail through Springfield, as well as some work on the McCoy's Creek Greenway, and we just want to know if this, you know, this study is going to take into consideration connectivity to those two things.
Yeah, you know, our limits were obviously just the Brooklyn neighborhood, but we did look at those other connectivity outside of that. McCoy's Creek, we know that there's some talk there of trying to do a plan, a greenway plan. So we looked at how the bikes could connect from there and then get down to the Riverwalk, because I think that'd be a great loop connector. And then even leading down into Five Points and other neighborhoods into Springfield. We looked at that. We just the scope could really get broad if we keep going. So we're hoping that through our study, we can make recommendations of how to connect to those other neighborhoods.
And a few moments ago, we mentioned how people can learn more about this. As Sandy writes on our Facebook page, walkable communities are a long way from reality here. I'd love to help this develop. How can people get more involved in this issue?
Well, the number one thing is look for those public meetings where you can come out and really voice your opinion. That's critical for us as designers. And even the owner of the project needs to hear people speak and give your input. There's probably not enough of that, and it's difficult. We know everyone's living their lives trying to do their daily routine. But when these public meetings come up and you look for those, that's the best way to do it.
When's the next meeting on this project?
We haven't set the date yet, but it'll be in late September. Just look for the Downtown Development Review Board meeting for September, and we'll be back there. It'll either be the 14th or 21st of September.
Thanks for this information. Really of lots of interest to our listeners out there.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Alan Iosu of Pond, that's the firm advising the Downtown Investment Authority on this issue. We'll continue to follow it. Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, why humility is the new smart. Find out why one author says that's the key to the modern workforce. But up next, it's our movable feast as we get a taste of Claude's chocolate. Back in a moment.
Next time on 1A, Simon Sinek. His TED Talk on leadership is one of the most watched ever, but it's his comments on millennials that sparked some controversy.
Before we label them and judge them, let us consider where they came from, and maybe everything will be more easily explained.
Simon Sinek on millennials and on winning at business by playing the right way. Next time on 1A, weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Summertime is learning time. WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Library are partnering to help families fight this summer slide with educational programming and online resources that encourage learning at home. Log on to wjct.org/education/summer to find summer reading lists, activity books, early literacy development tools, and much more. Help your child prepare for the new school year at wjct.org/education/summer.
On the next Jazz Night in America, John Scofield presents music from his record Quiet and reunites with his Blue Matter Electric Fusion roots.
When we started to play, I did get chills from the songs and remembering all the good times we had because the music reminds me of some real friends.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's a delicious business founded by a renowned chef. Now, it all began when St. Augustine's Claude Franck turned his talents to the art of chocolate making. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and culinary trends around the region, Lee Cord of the Women's Food Alliance speaks with Nicole Franck of Claude's Chocolate.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato.
I just have a taste for chocolate. And I am going to go back at least 15 years ago in St. Augustine when I met Nicole and Claude Franck, who had a little cafe, and I learned that they had moved to St. Augustine from New York City and came to make magic in food in our oldest city. So welcome, Nicole. I'm so happy you're with me to share with our listeners a little bit of the travelogue of your life with Claude and how you came, well, of course, from France to New York to St. Augustine.
Thank you. I met my husband, Claude, in my parents' French restaurant in Manhattan. They were they had a restaurant in the theater district, and they had a young new chef that was working, and they asked me to take him out and show him around New York. He was getting lonely.
What was the name of the restaurant?
The restaurant was called René Pujol. We managed the restaurant for over 25 years, René Pujol, yes. And when our children were, we have a boy and a girl, and when they were finished with college, they didn't mind us moving to a new place, and we had discovered St. Augustine through friends of ours that are retired in St. Augustine. It had a lot of European charm to it.
Yes.
And we packed up our bags. My parents weren't too happy, but we were excited about...
Well, that was probably the first time I met you was in your beautiful little bistro. And I'll never forget, every time I came in for lunch, the highlight to me of lunch was a little bonbon. And it was presented along with my check. And I went, I've never tasted chocolate like this in my life. Now, before we talk about how Claude's chocolate evolved, can you tell me how I'm supposed to pronounce bonbon the correct way?
It's pronounced bonbon.
Bonbon.
Bonbon in French means candy.
Oh, and I like it so much better when you say it.
and these bonbons are chocolate bonbons, the ones that we make.
So you're in St. Augustine, and Claude decides that he's going to become a chocolatier,
yes,
a fine chocolatier. And that was 15 years ago when Claude's began. Share with our listeners what Claude's Chocolate's philosophy is about chocolate making.
It's exactly like it was at the restaurant, where he likes to use good quality ingredients. So we do use a premium Belgian chocolate, and he likes things to be simple. And if you're going to eat a lime, like his lime drop chocolate, it's got to taste like lime. And it does. It tastes like a key lime pie in your mouth. So I think that's the main thing is good quality.
I'd say one of the most exciting things for me when I go into Claude's Chocolate, and you are on Granada Street in St. Augustine, in this little petite beautiful shop with a glass window, so you can actually see the Leitner Museum and Flagler College, and you're really in the heart of our oldest city, which is your retail location. I know that when you expanded, you needed actually a production facility that you have on US-1. Tell everybody where that's located so they can either stop in and occasionally see the chocolates being made by Claude, but also a retail location.
Yes, we are on US-1. We're between Nice High School and the Palencia development. That shop has a window. There's a partition that so you can see Claude making the chocolates.
When I first met Claude and you brought Claude's chocolate to North Florida. I'll never forget walking in, this tall, handsome gentleman with a hairnet, and he was roasting fresh nuts in this giant roaster. And I knew something important was going on because I had never heard of anybody roasting nuts fresh for the bonbon, for the candies.
Yeah.
You mentioned something earlier today, and it was about being uncompromising. What does that mean to Claude when he's making chocolate?
If he's buying strawberries or he's buying whatever ingredient he's buying, it's got to be of good quality and natural. He doesn't like anything artificial, and if it takes an hour to make, he's going to make it in an hour. He's not going to make it in half an hour. It's got to be, it's got to be just right. And that's the way he cooks. What makes them special is that it's a ganache center. So it's a creamy chocolate center.
Describe to our listeners what they will experience when they taste a Claude's chocolate. You have to close your eyes, by the way, even when you're eating them. First, you have to see them because they're beautiful. But then you close your eyes and you taste what?
The outside is a little firmer. There's a thinner layer of chocolate on the outside of the chocolate. And the inside is the creamy chocolate ganache. And it has all different flavorings. We make a spicy one that has like cinnamon, ancho, and chipotle. And it's important to take smaller bites and just let it melt in your mouth. And then you really taste the flavors.
And that's the way to eat a French bonbon. When I was younger, I used to eat bonbons and I'd pop it into my mouth. Now I'm going to eat a bonbon and just savor every little bite. Mm-hmm. What is your most popular? Now, when people are visiting St. Augustine or when locals eat your chocolates, what is the most popular one that just flies out of Claude's chocolate?
Well, the lime drop is very popular and peanut butters, but our best seller is actually a caramel. Claude makes a sea salt caramel that is to die for, and we can't make enough of them. So
they're unbelievably beautiful. And I recently learned that you have started doing chocolate classes at Claude's. And we don't have any information to share with our listeners yet, but they can go to your website and contact you at claudeschocolate.com and find out when the classes are. I know I'm going to have to sign up. I am going to learn how to make enrobed bonbon. Well, as we say goodbye today, I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to pick a bonbon. It has little pink, oh my heavens, it's dark chocolate and has little pink hearts on top. Tell me what I'm eating.
You're eating a crunchy milk chocolate peanut butter on the inside, which is enrobed in a dark chocolate on the outside.
Oh my heavens, yeah. Thank you for visiting with me on Movable Feast. I cannot wait to visit Claude and do a sampling. Thank you. We loved having you, Nicole.
Thank you.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
I'll take a box. We'll be right back.
Technology industry has a hiring problem.
We see people coming through new pathways to IT. In fact, about 15% of the people we hire each year in the U.S. don't have a bachelor's degree.
I'm Kai Rizdal. New paths into the technology economy. We'll have that story for you the rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities.
WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, America is about to undergo a major transformation with warnings of massive job losses that are not tied to our trade policies or immigration. No, worst-case predictions find that over the next couple of decades, millions of jobs in the U.S. will be lost to technology, automation, and artificial intelligence. And the authors of one new book say the fixation on bringing back manufacturing jobs is a mistake. Instead, they argue for a new mindset about the world of work. It's all in the new book, Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Co-author Catherine Ludwig is on the line with more. Catherine, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we've heard so much about this in the last couple of years, how to seek out a robot-proof job, for example. NPR has been doing a whole series on that. But there's real anxiety about this. The loss, you write, of up to 60 to 80 million U.S. jobs because of advancing technology. We're automating ourselves out of jobs. It's kind of worrisome for a lot of Americans. You and your co-author advocate that we start thinking about this differently. How do we do that?
Right. So I think it's a mistake to sort of try and predict what jobs will be available because this what we call a tsunami of artificial intelligence is going to displace employment and work activities across the board, from cognitive jobs to manual labor jobs, any job that you can think of. Pretty much somebody is developing an algorithm to automate it. And so what we advocate in our book is that we really need to start focusing on what are uniquely human skills and behaviors that technology either won't be able to do or we won't really want technology to take over for us. And we have found that those skills are emotional and social intelligence and critical and creative thinking. And collaborating. So instead of being able to answer questions, which is a lot of what the knowledge economy is about, it's really about asking the right questions and being able to solve complex problems and being able to work with each other and work for each other. And so this really is going to require a whole new mindset, a whole new idea, particularly for Americans, about what it means to be successful, which for so long has been about competition and individualism. So that's really the main crux.
And you argue that parents, schools, and businesses have to start thinking about how we raise and educate children and how we manage employees differently. It's a tough pull to move the culture in that direction. But in the book, you sort of argue that we're not going to have a choice, right?
Exactly. And so what we're saying is, it is going to be difficult, and it is difficult to sort of behave the way we advocate when you're working in an organization that's still playing by the old rules, or to raise your children when you still see people, sort of pursuing this very achievement-oriented road to success in college. It's difficult to buck that system, but what we're advocating is that you really want to be ahead of the curve, or you're going to be left behind, because this is really going to hit us. It's going to blindside a lot of Americans, I believe.
There has been some discussion I've seen recently about how to anticipate for this with solutions that have been floated, like universal basic income. When millions and millions of Americans are automated out of jobs, that the government's going to be forced to give people a stipend. That's not something you get into in your book, though. You're arguing for a different set of solutions, correct?
Well, what we're advocating for is really to empower individuals. I definitely agree, and we've been sort of, both my co-author and I have been writing about this, that, governments and organizations are really going to need to participate in solving these problems. But our book is really for individuals and individual leaders within organizations to, you know, sort of take the reins because, you know, they can't, an individual worker can't really affect these sort of macro forces, but what they can do is prepare themselves for whatever the future holds, and they can, you know, start preparing their mindsets and their behaviors to be able to react to this technological chaos that is coming. So, you know, becoming a more adaptable human, being a lot more socially and emotionally intelligent, because those are the parts of your job or any job that are going to be the most important for humans. And those are things that individuals can do without waiting for these sort of macro forces to be debated in terms of, you know, universal basic income or robot taxes or all of these things which have to be discussed. But, you know, our book is really trying to arm the individual so that they don't have to just sit back and wait to become displaced or irrelevant.
Pick up the book now. It's called Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Fascinating and timely. She's co-author Catherine Ludwig. Catherine, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime. Next on 1A, could crisis lead to civil war in Venezuela? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.